When the Jesuit priest, Gerard Manley Hopkins, died on the 8th of June, 1889, at the age of 44, his memory looked likely to slide into dignified obscurity. Almost 30 years after his death, however, in 1918, 750 copies of a slim volume of Hopkins's poems were brought into print for the first time. And everything changed. His literary genius was immediately recognised, and he is today universally regarded as amongst the finest writers of his age, or of any age. As a Catholic poet in English, he has no rival. My name is Michael Hurley, and I teach at the University of Cambridge. I'm also chairman of the Christian Heritage Centre at Stonyhurst. In this podcast, I have the pleasure of discussing one of Hopkins's most moving and timely poems, God's Grandeur, which features this year within the Easter service at Stonyhurst College. Dr. Jan Grafius, curator of the museum, library and archives at Stonyhurst, joins me together with Dr. Rebecca Lamb from the University of St. Andrews, who is also a trustee of the Christian Heritage Centre. Rebecca will start us off by introducing us to Hopkins's life, after which we'll tease out some of the remarkable literary and theological richness of his poetry, and consider some of his significant connections with Stonyhurst too. In listening to the discussion that follows, you may wish to have a copy of God's Grandeur to hand, and we will post a link to the text. Over to you, Rebecca.
Thank you for starting up the conversation, Michael, and it's such a pleasure to be with you and Jan today to talk about Gerard Manley Hopkins. As Michael said, I'm first going to set some of the stage historically and theologically, as well as aesthetically, for our discussion of Gerard Manley Hopkins. And once I've overviewed some key aspects of his history, then we'll turn to a closer look at his poem, God's Grandeur. Hopkins was born in 1844 in Stratford, Essex, which is now part of Greater London. He lived a remarkable, yet also hidden and relatively short life, dying from typhus in 1889 at the young age of 44. From early childhood, he was a talented poet and sketcher, drawn to the beauty of the natural world and possessing an almost forensic attention to rural landscapes and skyscapes, to their shapes, sounds, smells, and unique particularities. Hopkins also had a deep love for languages, especially English and its various dialects, and Greek. As we will discuss at more length later on, his innovative rhythmic system, known as sprung rhythm, grew out of his fascination with not only the meaning of words, but also their inherent musicality, their sounds, cadences, variations, and organic developments. Hopkins's naturally poetic eye and ear were both identifiable from a young age. While studying at the Highgate School during adolescence, he was awarded a prestigious poetry prize for his impressive imitations of John Keats. He read classics at Oxford, he became known as the Star of Balliol College, and won the special patronage and friendship of his tutor, Walter Pater. It was while at Oxford that Hopkins also befriended Robert Bridges, who would become a famous Victorian poet and publisher in his own right. It is thanks to Bridges that the world was introduced to Hopkins's poetry in 1918, as Michael already mentioned. During his studies at Oxford, Hopkins became fascinated by the doctrines of Roman Catholicism, especially those related to Eucharistic theology and the sacraments. He made the then controversial decision to convert to Roman Catholicism shortly after his graduation, since, at that time, Roman Catholics still could not take degrees. It was not until 1896 that what has been called a full Catholic return to Oxford was permitted. Hopkins's conversion was encouraged and supported by John Henry Newman, who was a famous Oxford scholar and Anglican curate who converted to Roman Catholicism and was then ordained a Catholic priest and founded the first Oratorian congregation in England in Birmingham. For a time, Hopkins taught at one of the schools Newman founded, but by the age of 23, he decided to join the Jesuit order. In the early days of his newly founded religious zeal, Hopkins burned his poetry, an act which he referred to as the slaughter of the innocents in his journal. He believed he would never write poetry again, and instead would devote himself to his Jesuit vocation and ministry. It was precisely in his Jesuit novitiate, however, that Hopkins would eventually discover that far from being in tension, faith and poetry can enrich each other. After all, the Jesuit tradition has a rich artistic one. Hopkins entered the Jesuit novitiate at Manresa House in Roehampton, and then studied at St. Mary's Hall at Stonyhurst. A little later on in our podcast, you will get the chance to hear more about the fascinating connections between Hopkins' poetry and Stonyhurst College. While studying philosophy at Stonyhurst, Hopkins became an enthusiastic reader of the medieval theologian Duns Scotus. Scotus's theological and devotional approach to the Christian faith helped restore Hopkins's sense that perhaps the life of poetry and priestly ministry were not incompatible after all. However, Hopkins did not return to writing poetry until 1874, while at St. Bino's College in North Wales. His long period of poetic silence was broken by a tragic event, the drowning of over 150 people, including five Franciscan nuns, exiled from Germany as a result of the country's anti-Catholic penal system. The poem is a sweeping, idiosyncratic, and remarkably beautiful achievement, exploring a wide-ranging set of themes characterizing Hopkins's poetry. The relationship between personal suffering and divine providence is the main organizing feature of the poem. Hopkins tried to get the poem published in the Jesuit periodical The Month, but it was rejected. It was deemed too irregular. Unfortunately, this rejection was the first in a series of disappointments for Hopkins. His poetry could not find publishers, and therefore it had no public, apart from a small readership of close friends, Robert Bridges among them. As already mentioned, the world did not get introduced to Gerard Manley Hopkins' poetry until 1918, nearly 30 years after his death. Disappointments and misunderstanding followed Hopkins throughout much of his life. Quiet, acutely sensitive, and never in robust health, Hopkins found the rigors of Jesuit life and ministry difficult. As Ruth Padell reminds us, between his ordination in 1877 and his move to Dublin in 1884, Hopkins worked in 11 places, including London, Oxford, Manchester, Sheffield, Liverpool, and Glasgow. His final appointment was in Dublin, where he lived between 1884 and 1889. Contracting typhoid and dying shortly thereafter, Hopkins was buried away from family and friends in the Jesuit cemetery in Dublin. Hopkins greatly cherished the sense of home, of familiar scenes, of English rural landscapes, and the company of sympathetic friends. In Dublin, he wrote that he felt alienated and alone, at a third remove from his old life. It is in his Dublin years that we see Hopkins, the nature poet, plunge even further into the existential realities of the human condition, finding poetry as a way of thinking through his suffering and of making acts of faith and hope in the midst of his mental and spiritual anguish. When Hopkins passed away, some of his final words were, however, "I am so happy, I am so happy." In many ways, poetry served as a lifeline for him and enabled him to persevere in his priestly ministry until the very end of his life. In his Jesuit vocation, he came to embrace a rich, nuanced vision of the world that could see in suffering a closer contact with Christ, the figure who most significantly appears and reappears throughout Hopkins' poetry. He is the bluebell. He is present in the flux and change of the world. He is present in the dark nights of wrestling. And as Hopkins would put it, Christ is even present in the lovely behavior of silk sack clouds. The interplay between faith and nature is a central and abiding theme throughout Hopkins' poetry, opening up readings for those of us interested in how we may come to care more greatly for what Pope Francis in Laudato Si has called our common home, the natural world. In the time remaining, we will have a look at one of Hopkins' nature sonnets, God's Grandeur, which explores the relationship between a variety of ecologies, the natural ecologies, human ecologies, and spiritual ones too. So now I'm going to turn it back to Michael, who is going to help us think about some of the overall shape and significances of God's grandeur.
Thank you very much, Rebecca. I'm struck as you talking about him being too irregular. This is a charge that follows him around amongst many of his friends, and he was rather dispirited by that. You also spoke about his deep interest in the meaning and what you call the inherent musicality of his words. And again, both of these are in an interesting interplay for Hopkins, the relationship between meaning and musicality. So before we get to the poem proper, I thought I might just say a little bit about how we attune our ear to Hopkins. You know, you crack open a Hopkins book and the sonnets and other poems there before you. What do you do? What should you be looking for and listening out for? Broadly speaking, I wanted to share three observations. And many of these are in some ways self-evident if you open and read Hopkins. We can see and we can hear what I'm going to describe, but it's another thing to know what to do with that, what to do with what confronts us in Hopkins, who is such a singular poet, such an unusual poet. No one else writes like Hopkins, not even close. So the first observation I really wanted to make and share is about Hopkins's intensity and his stress. So Hopkins says that poetry is not like normal language, it's language heightened. At one point, he describes it as being purged of dross like gold, very powerful. One critic says that, you know, Hopkins doesn't write like people speak, but he writes like people speak if they could speak poetry. So there's a sense of a real ultra distillation of the linguistic mode itself, that poetry is at this pitch. And we see this linguistically in that he deletes any words he doesn't want, and maybe some words we might want to try to understand what he's saying, articles and particles and conjunctions and pronouns sometimes, or the syntax is put in slightly odd order, not willfully, not perversely for its own sake, but because he wants to generate other kinds of expressive possibility. And some of his words do double work. He has all sets of puns, or he plays on etymologies of words, sometimes triple work. And he has compound words, and he has words that slightly change their inflection of their meaning as they tip over the line. We're following the line, and then we tip over and we see, oh, actually that word means something else, and so on. And I know Rebecca's going to help us think about that for God's Grandeur in particular. Hopkins likes, as an expression of this intensity, very tight forms. He especially loves the sonnet form, and he plays experimentally with different kinds of sonnet. He makes them shorter, he makes them longer. He boasts at one point about having written the longest sonnet ever made, and so on. And Rebecca mentioned also his innovative rhythmic structure. He called this sprung rhythm, and we won't go down the rabbit hole of exactly what sprung rhythm is. When I was doing my doctorate, which is in fact on Hopkins, one wise professor leaned into me and said, you know, prosody, that's the study of meter and rhythm, he says, that's where academics go to die. So we won't go down there, but other than to say that Hopkins himself glossed it for us, he said that it means something like abrupt. And what he meant by that is, if you think about, you know, Shakespeare line, iambic pentameter, we're familiar with di-dum, di-dum, di-dum. What Hopkins is thinking of is that you can create a certain kind of effect by springing or sprunging the rhythm, by having, instead of di-dum, di-dum, it would be di-dum, dum-di. So you get the stresses colliding with each other. And so he comes back again and again to this idea of stressy, passionate. He admires some Wordsworth poems, but some of his sonnets, he says, have an odious goodiness about them. So they're too luxuriant. They give you too easy a ride. So for Hopkins, we need to brace ourselves. And the final thing on intensity and stress is that many of the rhythms and the sounds are tongue-twistering. He recommended Edward Lear to his mother. And I think any recommendations to one's mother we need to take seriously. And this is there are occasions when Lear does sound like Hopkins, or Hopkins like Lear. And before we get to the poem that's our subject today, I just wanted to read just one stanza from his book, from his first major poem, The Wreck of the Deutschland, which Rebecca mentioned. So this is just a short stanza to give you a sense of what this intensity, this stress that I've been describing sounds like. This is stanza 8 from The Wreck of the Deutschland. Is out with it. Oh, we lash with the best or worst word last, how a lush kept plush cap slow will, mouth to flesh burst, gush, flush the man, the being with it, sour or sweet, brim in a flash full, hither then, last or first, to hero of Calvary, Christ's feet, never ask if meaning it, wanting it, warned of it, men go. So you can see the challenge for the audible reading of that, and there's a great challenge reading it on the page too. And I leave that with you as a taster, a literal taster, as it were, something to turn around in your mouth. So the two other things I wanted to say, just by general introduction to Hopkins's poetics before we get to this poem and start unpicking it for you, is that he's quite odd and obscure. Now, these aren't my words. These are the words of Robert Bridges in the preface to his 1914 poems after Hopkins's death, which launches him. Hopkins is sort of bracing his reader, and I'm bracing you in turn. And Bridges, although the great champion of Hopkins, there's a very moving letter that we have from Hopkins when he's evidently sent Bridges his first major poem, this great unleashing of this rhythm that he said had long been haunting his ear. He sends it to Bridges, and Bridges evidently writes back to him and says, "I wouldn't for all the money in the world ever read your poem again." To which Hopkins in reply says, "You know, you said you wouldn't for all the money in the world ever read my poem again. Besides money, you know, there is love." And I think there's a kind of double injunction there with Hopkins. He means the love of their, you know, their great friendship, which wasn't without its fraught moments, but in any event, their great friendship, but also that one needs to learn to love something. And Hopkins talks again about how verse can be weathered, and the way to weather the verse, or to be weathered to the verse, is to read it. And so we shouldn't, I think, approaching Hopkins, fuss too much about the oddity and obscurity in the first instance, but read it, and in particular, read it aloud. Hopkins says, you know, "Such verses I compose as oral, and I put it down on paper with repugnance." So there's a real sense of the life of verse coming off the page as we read it. And then the third and final thing before we get to the poem proper, is that I don't want in this introduction to having served up oddity and obscurity to you in intensity, to imagine that Hopkins is doing some kind of verbal pyrotechnics for their own sake. It's not just a kind of a show of rhythm and sound and words that we watch. He's very keen to insist again and again, and with increasing exasperation, it turns out, to his friends, that the form that he's engaged with is not a kind of open license, that he says, and, you know, he turns back on his friends and says, you know, "I'm stricter than you are, and that my laws are, in fact, are deep, and they're only apparent licenses." And at one point he says that, "Look, I'm going to provide prose paraphrases for my poems to show you that they mean something." But the key thing is that Hopkins didn't think that the prose paraphrase would be the meaning of the poem, that somehow the meaning comes out of this intensity. And correspondingly, he's very impatient with other poets, he thinks, who are merely turning their verbal wheels, or trying on of style, as a phrase he comes back to again and again with disapprobation. And he says of his contemporary Swinburne that, and he recognizes Swinburne's genius, but he says it's a perpetual functioning of genius without truth. So Hopkins is trained on truth as he saw it, and I was threaded through the eye of the needle of his Catholic faith. And the final way to wrap all of this up, I think, is there's a very suggestive moment in one of Hopkins's writings where he says to a correspondent that, you know, poems should be clear, but there are two kinds of clarity. There's one kind of clarity where it's clear as you go along, you understand word by word, phrase by phrase, line by line, and so on. But he says there's another kind which isn't clear immediately. He says it's dark at first reading, but when it does become clear, it explodes. And that's, I think, what we need to keep in mind for Hopkins's poems, these kind of staged explosions, which are explosions of meaning, where the meaning isn't just what the words mean, but the meaning is the charge is lit, as it were, by all this kind of sonic and rhythmic intensity that I've been describing. But for all that, Hopkins does say, you know, you can't just feel these poems, you do also have to study them too. So I think Rebecca is now going to help us a little bit to pick through some of the more difficult words and phrases in God's Grandeur, which is the object of our particular interest today.
Thank you, Michael, for your insights into the poetics, the unique poetics of Hopkins. There were a series of words that you used to describe his poetical approach, which I think are very helpful to bear in mind as we approach reading God's Grandeur or thinking about it perhaps for the first time. But even if it's not your first time, one thing I do find, not just about any poem, but especially Hopkins's poems, is that they grow in the revisiting, and they especially grow in the saying out loud. So I do encourage those of you who get interested in Hopkins or who love him already to take time to go back and read his poetry out loud and perhaps even memorize it. I found that even though his poems still require decoding each time I return to it and I discover new layers of meaning, the times where I feel like I get closer to the different things that Hopkins is presenting to us, those times are when I've memorized some of his poetry and have been able to, say it while I'm, say, going for a walk or thinking about it and ruminating over it. There were certain words that you raised, Michael, that I think are so helpful as descriptors of this poem and Hopkins's approach in general. Stress, strain, explosion. These sorts of things very much characterize his approach to the creative process. Very often in his poetry, he talks about the work and the labor that it takes to try to do justice to a thing. So in the first few sentences, let's start off, in the first few lines of the poem, we see Hopkins use a kind of set of descriptions that make us think of things like electricity and lightning bolts and energy. And of course, as we may know, in the Victorian period, it became the kind of electric age. And one critic has even talked about how a lot of Victorian poetry seemed to be galvanized, as it were. It was very interested in the ways in which emergent scientific understandings could help further inform our understanding about larger metaphysical concerns and situations. In the opening of the poem, we hear Hopkins say, "The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil." So his first observation is that the world is, as he says, touched by the presence of a creator and a mighty one at that, one full of power and energy and dynamism. He's very interested in the interplay between flux and change and also energy that we can see in the created world. However, something that also pervades Hopkins' poetic sensibility is a sense of the kind of entropic drift, the way in which we seem to be always already moving towards decay. And so there's a strange entanglement between life and decay, between energy and the loss of energy that is at work in Hopkins' poem. And it very often helps Hopkins describe some of the problems of suffering or the limitations of our human condition, or of exploring there's something out of joint. This world is splendid and beautiful, and yet there are these problems. The fact of death, the problem of suffering are present within our very love of nature and our appreciation for its beauty. So he starts off by saying the world is animated by the power and presence of God as creator. And many critics have viewed this as also a reference to God the Father. In the opening of the book of Genesis, we very much are introduced to a God who is potent and active. And when he says something, that very word that he utters can actually create or make life. So after noting the power and presence of God, then he shows the way in which the energy of God's creative actions and activities within history, they gather together, he says, they gather to a greatness, like the ooze of oil crushed. And even here, the way in which he affects this sense of the power and coming together of God's creative energy, it's not only represented in the references he makes and in the descriptions he makes, but also in the very structure of the poem itself. So the presence of God is so bountiful that it can't be contained by a line in a poem. It has to carry over and spill over into the third and the fourth and the fifth lines. So the first couple of lines of the stanza establish there is a powerful and provident creator. Then he switches from an observation about the nature of God, with a particular emphasis on God the Father, And he turns to the human condition. So we've had a wide sweep of the nature of creation, God's presence in it, and now he focuses on the human condition, and he asks the question. And always note, when a poet asks a question, they're inviting us in a very particular way, to start to think through why the poet has the particular concern or care or problem that he or she does have. Why do men then now not wreck his rod? Before we look at some of the different word plays that Hopkins is achieving here, we should first perhaps parse out what the sentence itself means. When he asks, why do men then now not wreck his rod? He's asking, why do they not reckon with or think through his presence and power? Now, I just want to highlight what the word rod means in the particular poetic context of Hopkins' own work. The word rod crops up elsewhere, particularly in one of his more existential and difficult sonnets called Carrion Comfort, where he realizes in his spiritual wrestling that what can seem to be the rod or the rule of God is also the hand of God, and that there is a close relationship between the power of God and his mercy, between justice and mercy in particular. And so here what he asks is, given the grandeur of the created world, which for Hopkins compels us to believe in a God, or at least to entertain the question of God, why in looking at all this power of creation does humanity not consider the presence and the rule and the providence of God? And then he follows on to say, generations have trod. And of course, there are certain echoes with these words, trod, with God and rod. And here Hopkins is trying, especially through the kinds of pairings in terms of rhythm and rhyming, he's trying to consolidate all of these concerns and questions together. And he's suggesting in this question that if humanity paid more attention to the splendor and the wonder of creation, perhaps they would also be more careful with it and be better stewards of it. And perhaps they also wouldn't be stuck in a kind of mundane historical existence where one is just trotting or plodding through life. He continues on to talk about the world being seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil. And here, of course, he's writing in the context of the Industrial Revolution. And for all of its wondrous developments technologically, it was also, of course, a point of very great concern for the Victorians as well. You see many of the poets and artists of this time period, as well as theologians, encouraging people to remember the role and the value and dignity of nature and of persons too. And here he's emphasizing that humanity has failed to be a good steward of the created order. And Michael, I've in our chats about this poem before, you've talked about the double meaning of charged within this poem. And I thought perhaps you might want to jump in and talk about it, because I think it ties the opening of the poem very nicely with the concerns presented towards the end of this stanza.
Sure. Well, I know that Jan is going to have some interesting things to say about charged as well. But yes. In our conversation, Rebecca, we were discussing the extent to which charged is that we are charged with the duty. So insofar as the world is charged with God, we are charged with the husbandry or the care of that grandeur. So I think that, and as you parse it out very lucidly, there's something about that first line that occurs to me that stands, as it were, for the whole poem. And it's you mentioned how the lines that spill over with that untrammeled energy, this line has a kind of axiomatic force. It stands almost like a title for the whole poem. So I think that sense of charged, again, and so much like Hopkins, we don't even know that the word is doing that work when we first read the line. And so the rereading injunction that you gave us is so important, because it's only through weathering, as I was saying before, that we get the sense of how the poem is itself charged with this double meaning of charged.
I'll just take a little bit more time now to shift from the first stanza, which sets up the situation as Hopkins sees it, that the world is wondrous, It is clearly shaped and comes from an energetic and dynamic God who also has a provident care over creation. And in here, Hopkins is also drawing very much from his interest in the medieval theologian Duns Scotus, and in his interest in medieval literature, which really emphasizes that nature is to be read as the book of God. It is authored by God, and he is seeking to communicate and share certain aspects about himself, but also about the role of nature in and of itself, and of humans within humanity within the natural world. And so what Hopkins is also concerned about here is the way in which the human abuse of the natural world is also kind of marring or smearing the natural landscape, and thereby making it harder for us to discern the presence of God within the world. He talks about God as being he who heeds and hides, bodes but abides, and that part of the charge of the human person is, or you know, the invitation to the human person is to try to discern the deeper meanings within the natural world, and to have a contemplative approach to the world and view it as something to care for, as opposed to have ownership over or complete possession over. So in the first stanza, he sets out the situation, the problem, that we have not cared for creation in the way that we are supposed to. And so for many critics, even those who might not have a particular theological investment in the poem, for example, but perhaps more of an eco-critical one or an ethical one, find this poem a really helpful articulation in the Victorian period of some of the pressing concerns about our relationship between technology, nature, and our responsibility within those two things. In the second stanza, we see a solution, or Hopkins' proposed solution to the problem and predicament that he has presented to us in the preceding stanza. And here we see a certain shift here, a sudden turn in the language and the perspective of the poetic voice. Previously, we've seen a catalog of different ways in which people have abused creation, and now we see that there's still hope even in the face of these problems. And for all this, he says, nature is never spent. So here he's signaling a very interesting approach to even certain ecological questions and concerns that we in our contemporary context can certainly share with him, right, and share as a matter of urgency. He's suggesting here that the power of nature is never fully spent, because there is the presence of the Holy Spirit who operates within the development of history, giving people signs of hope and inspiration, and continually seeking to renovate or recreate creation and humanity. The other thing that's very important to bear in mind is that in mentioning the Holy Spirit, of course, and in clearly referencing the Trinity in general in this poem, Hopkins is also looking ahead to the hope for the ultimate renewal and transformation of all of the created world and of humanity and the second coming. So there's an eschatological vision that's present as well in the final stanza. So there's a lot more that could be said about this poem, but I'd like now to turn it back to Michael.
Wonderful. Well, the reason I'm butting in here in our agreed choreography is just to bring us back, because I knew that in the divvying up of our roles of what we were going to talk about, that I anticipated, because I know Rebecca, that she would do such a fine job of explication that we could imagine that, in fact, well, why can't we just have the paraphrase after all? Why do we need the poem at all if we parse out all these different and deep meanings? And I think the point is that Rebecca, in fact, recurred to several times very helpfully, is that the poem is not like a detective story where you work it out and you find the punchline is, you know, the bishop was my father or something like that. And then you don't need to read the story again. And indeed, to read the story again would be a bit tedious because you know what it means, as it were. You've solved the puzzle. In the question that of the word charged, for example, that Rebecca spoke about, knowing that that word is charged with multiple meanings itself, that we are put in charge, as it were, and so on. This is a further enrichment. And Rebecca spoke about memorizing poetry and knowing it by heart. And I think that even that locution, knowing something by heart, is very suggestive, I think, of exactly what Hopkins was saying. You know, besides money, you know, there is love. You know, how do you love a poem, not merely in some kind of sappy, sentimental way, but really understand it, those deep down things that Rebecca was referring to. And as Rebecca was saying, there's many other things that might be said about even just that diurnal cycle of how the morning comes after the night and so on, and how spring comes after winter. And of course, it's such a perfect Easter poem from that point of view, because of the renewal that comes not just within the Western Hemisphere of the season with the spring, but the Easter promise, which is of a Christological renewal. The first thing to notice, Rebecca's described the first and the second stanzas, and of course that's quite right. But we need to pan out a little bit further, of course, to recognise that it's a sonnet. And what a sonnet meant for Hopkins was something very significant. I mentioned that it allows him to achieve his desired intensity and passion because of the tight rhyming and the prescribed form and so on. But Hopkins had pretty strong views on sonnets, as in particular as a kind of mode of thought. And that is to say that a sonnet works, many of you will know, according to a shape that has a volta in it, has a turn in it. Something is opens with the poem, an observation or a condition or a sentiment or a problem or whatever it might be. And that's somehow wrestled with, reconciled, resolved. And one critic makes a distinction between the two kinds of sonnets in this way. So the two kinds of sonnets that you'll be familiar with is the Italian or Petrarchan form. This is what Hopkins has here. And the volta, the turn point, comes after the eighth line, after the octave. But there is also the English sonnet form, or the Shakespearean sonnet form, of which many of you will be familiar through Shakespeare's own example. And that's very different. One critic points out that the trouble with the English form, or the Shakespeare form, or the form that Shakespeare made famous, he says that its volta happens, as he notices, very often in the last two lines. The last two lines of a Shakespeare or English sonnet are a couplet. And he says it puts one in minds of pins and balloons, as if you have this big problem and then you pop it, as it were, in the last two lines. So you can think of something like, "Let me not to the marriage of true minds" ends, "If this be error and upon me proved, I never writ, nor no man ever loved," or "My mistress eyes are nothing like the sun" ends, "And yet by heaven I think my love," and that "and yet" is signalling the volta, "and yet by heaven I think my love as rare as any she belied with false compare," and so on. Now, Hopkins doesn't like this, because he likes this more sustained wrestle and tussle. And so when we get that line, "And for all this nature is never spent," which Rebecca's opened up for us, we have to understand that in the context of Hopkins now shifting gear in quite a very self-conscious, sonnet-minded way to renegotiate what's gone before. And so that renegotiation isn't just a flipping of the switch, it's not a popping of the balloon, but that which has been articulated in the octave in the previous eight lines is then drawn down. And so the poems aren't linear in that way, but they are somehow coterminous. They're working all at the same time. So that's the first thing to notice. I have just two other observations. So we need to remember that it's a sonnet. The other second observation I wanted to make was about how we read it. I mentioned sprung rhythm before, and this poem isn't actually, by Hopkins's account, in sprung rhythm, but he says it's counterpointed. And he means by that it really participates in that essential quality of sprung rhythm without being sprung throughout. And that essential quality that I parsed earlier via Hopkins is of abruptness, of stressiness. So he notes the word grandeur, for example, and gathers and generations. He puts a little twirl above them, as he puts it. And that's to show that we've got a kind of stress wrinkle going on there. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It sort of stands out there. It's not a kind of easy alternation of rhythm. And this is important. We might think, well, isn't this just the ornamentation? Isn't this just the kind of sheen on the substantial semantic meanings that Rebecca has parsed at? Well, not according to Hopkins. He says in a series of different letters to friends, if my lines are not rightly scanned, they are ruined. So it's not that, you know, I would prefer they were read in this way or that way, or it's particularly pretty, or it's particularly engaging if you read it this way. No, that the particular words, particular kind of collisions, particular kind of assonance and alliteration needs to be drawn out in a particular way in order for the poem to mean as it must mean, or to go back to the word I used before, which is Hopkins's word, if it's going to explode. So we can't read it, as if it's just a bit of prose. We have to understand that it's doing particular work. And Hopkins is so obsessive about this that he develops these diacritical marks derived from music. He has 21 different marks for music, and he annotates all his poems. And there's no single edition in print that has these, partly because editors share Hopkins's own sense that they're offensive, that they are somehow, you know, they get in the way and they look a bit messy and so on. But Hopkins says, but we still need some, and we need some. The burden of that need is because if the poem is not read correctly, then it's ruined. So there really is this burden. We don't just move from thinking, well, you know, what does the poem mean? And then let's see how the rhythms sort of bring it to life. The life of what it means is in hearing in some very powerful way through the rhythm and through the sound. And this is very dramatic and very radical. And I mentioned earlier Edward Lear, and you know, there's a real sense in which Hopkins is pushing it to the absolute limit, the rhythm and the sound, and he's not doing it merely for an effect. He's doing it to this very considered purpose, in the way we see it in something like Lear as nonsense. But for someone like Hopkins, he's saying, no, if you remember, it needs to be trained on truth. So on the recitation of this poem in particular, there aren't many diacritical marks, so we're kind of off the hook a little bit there. Grandeur gathers generations, he puts his twirls on. But he does give a little note in a letter of how to read it. And he says simply, it's to be read slowly, strongly marking the rhythms and fetching out the syllables. And I think I'll pass it over at this point to Jam, because I know that she has something wonderful to tell us about Bright Wings in respect of Hopkins and Stonyhurst.
Thank you, Michael and Rebecca. I'm having such a fascinating time listening to this poem being unpacked in all its riches. I have to say, I've got the best job in the world. I look after the historically rich collections of Stonyhurst, which have been gathered together over the last five centuries. We are the oldest surviving Jesuit school in the world, founded in 1593. And for the last 250 years or so, we've been set in glorious Lancashire countryside, which is much loved by Hopkins, as he recorded in his letters and journals. One of the great treats of living in this beautiful part of the world is that you get to go and sit in Hopkins' bluebell woods. The bluebells will be out in about 3 weeks' time, and I will go and sit there in the cloughs that he talked about and marvel at how many different shades of blue he could describe in a bluebell. For a priest, therefore, he was in an inspirational place. Inspirational in a spiritual sense, but also in a sense of beauty and nature, which really spoke to him. I mean, even the slightly quirky naming of the year groups at the college would have had an appeal for the poet in him. They're called elements, figures, rudiments, grammar, syntax, poetry, rhetoric, and philosophy, taking you from primary school to undergraduate level. I don't know if I'm allowed to mention a brief rabbit hole, but when I was looking for materials to talk about yesterday, I came across the school's wedding register, because the big church, St. Peter's, is also a parish church. And there was, in 1882, Gerard Manley Hopkins presiding at a wedding of a local couple. I just would love to know what his homily was. It's never been recorded. But suddenly there in the middle of this rather dry book full of copperplate is his distinctive curly signature. And what a privilege to be married by Gerard Manley Hopkins. I must trace the family, see if they're still around. As a curator, I tend to start from physical evidence, looking to tease out inspiration and insight from things to allow them to tell a story. And two things occurred to me in considering this poem: the spiritual, encapsulated in an image of an embroidered dove on a beautiful 17th century vestment, which is held at Stonyhurst on behalf of the British Jesuit province. And the choice of his words in the very first line, as Michael and Rebecca have both referred to, The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil, which strongly suggests to me a galvanic, electrical, scientific approach. So let's look at that first. It's not terribly well known that Hopkins was a keen amateur scientist and that he assisted in the experimental work of the College Observatory. The Jesuits have included the study of physical, natural, and cosmological sciences in their curriculum since 1599. There are about 30 craters on the moon that are named after Jesuit astronomers. The study of the laws of the universe reflect on the lawgiver, on the creator, on God. And looking at the history of our school at Stonyhurst in particular, there's evidence of practical scientific study dating back to the 17th century. And the first recorded experiments with electricity at Stonyhurst occurred in 1824. As Rebecca was saying, that the 19th century was a place of huge exploration of the physical world, the natural physical world, and this all these new phenomena that were becoming possible. So in 1849, new electromagnetic equipment was installed at the college in what was described as a self-regulating electric and magnetic observatory. The study of electromagnetics was, of course, pioneered by the great physicist Faraday, who taught William Kay, who was the professor of natural philosophy, physics, and studied electricity at Stonyhurst from the 1850s onwards. So you've got almost like a direct link through the person of Father Kay to one of the greatest physicists of the 19th century, and the person who more than anybody helped to define what electricity was and how it shapes our world. The newly founded observatory was run, obviously, by a Jesuit, Alfred Weld. He was a formidable scientist. In fact, he'd published his findings in a scientific journal on the existence of sunspots the previous year. Alfred Weld, of course, also was to receive the young Gerard Manley Hopkins into the Society of Jesus. And when Hopkins arrived at SMH, that's at St. Mary's Hall, I should say, which is the seminary at Stonyhurst and is now the prep school, in 1870, Alfred Weld was the superior of the seminary. So there was a link there already. You've got a great scientist, you've got a personal friendship link, and you've got this young seminarian, Gerard Manley Hopkins, turning up at a place which is just full of the most extraordinary promise, natural beauty, scientific experiments. This obviously greatly appealed to him. The place of the College of Stonyhurst in the reputation of scientific study in the 19th century has never been fully appreciated. It was in the vanguard of the study of electromagnetic, meteorological, which was very important for Hopkins, the study of the weather, and astronomical science. And the observatory staff regularly published their findings in respective scientific journals. To further their magnetic experiments, the Jesuits created an underground chamber for electromagnetic experiments shortly before Hopkins arrived at the seminary in 1870. As a new seminarian, a seminarian is a sort of trainee priest, Hopkins was taught a very rigorous curriculum, logic, metaphysics, and philosophy. But in keeping with the Jesuit emphasis on the sciences, he was also taught advanced mathematics, spherical geometry, which makes my head hurt even thinking about it, cosmology and mechanics. His second year teacher was Stephen Perry. Perry was a Jesuit, a deeply respected astronomer. He's a fellow of the Royal Society. He lectured internationally, and he was one of the government observers sent to record eclipses, lunar eclipses, solar eclipses, and so on. But he also taught Gerard Manley Hopkins mathematics. Perry was deeply into the exploration of space, solar eclipses, the measurement of sunspots. He devised the first measurement of sunspots method, which was called the Stonyhurst method. But he was a very gentle and warm person. He wasn't keen on shutting himself away. And he encouraged like-minded young Jesuits, such as Hopkins, to work in the observatory, to observe the weather, taking rain gauge and sun readings and writing up the electromagnetic readings. And we know Hopkins mentions the rain gauge in one of his letters. He's slightly unkind about Lancashire. He said it's the wettest place in the world. It just feels like it. There are other wetter places. But it's clear from reading Hopkins's contributions to Nature magazine, for instance, the famous Krakatoa sunsets, and from his letters and journals, that he had an advanced understanding of the scientific language of meteorology. He was using correct terms for the description of cloud formations, for instance. His observations from the 1870s include technical terms, rayons de crépuscule, solar halos, and the use of scientific terminology for the different types of clouds. And as a keen observer of language and the minutiae of nature, it's easy to see how these words appeal to him. As I say, you only have to read his descriptions of sunsets after Krakatoa in Lancashire to realize how he could fuse scientific and poetic language. Is it sort of iced crimson quilted silk describing the fields with these extraordinarily vivid sunsets appearing on them? I'll just read you a little section from a college publication describing one of these extraordinarily bonkers sort of scientific equipment in the underground magnetic chamber, just so that you can imagine how an impressionable mind like Hopkins, which was moved by mysterious forces and by light and by the unusual. So imagine going into an underground chamber. The magnet is suspended horizontally so that it lies pointing towards the magnetic poles. To the magnet is attached a mirror, which therefore moves with the magnet. A mirror is also attached in a fixed position to the pillar in the same plane as the magnet. A beam of light is projected onto these two mirrors from a burning gas jet at the side, and by a suitable adjustment of lenses, the mirrors and the jet being so arranged that the light reflected from the mirrors travels up the tube to the revolving cylinders. We thus have two beams of light, one reflected from either mirror, traveling up the tube. I can't imagine anybody witnessing something like that and not thinking this is extraordinarily strange, beautiful, magical, weird. You can see how he was drawn to it. The second sort of thought I had in relation to this poem was when reading the last two lines that Michael and Rebecca have so beautifully read. The Holy Ghost over the bent world broods with bright wings, with bright wings. And this suddenly came to me that one of the most exquisite and creatively beautiful vestments that we look after at the college is a red velvet 17th century Pentecost vestment. The vestments are always red. And this was embroidered by a remarkable woman, a 17th century woman called Helena Winter, who had a checkered childhood. Her father and uncles were unfortunate gunpowder plotters and were executed when she was five. And she spent her entire life embroidering the most extraordinary set of spiritually symbolic, poetic vestments, which luckily have survived and are at the college. And it suddenly occurred to me that this dove would have been known to Hopkins. He would have been able to see it. He would have been able to engage with it. He was regularly in the sacristy in the college chapel as a seminarian, which is sort of the lowest level of Jesuit on the staff. The seminarians were expected to help out on big occasions. And so we know that he was in the sacristy where these beautiful vestments were kept. One of the other influences that would have attracted Hopkins was the presence of the sacristan, James Horton. I have a great affection for James Horton. We have a photograph of him. He was the sacristan for 60 years. He died in 1876. So when Hopkins was there in the 1870s, he would have been a venerable man. What I love about Horton is his adoration of the work, which was caring for the vestments and making them presentable for the beauty of God. And the worship that took place in the church. As a curator, I bless him regularly because he wrote things down. There are 12 notebooks which are written by Horton, describing in minute detail the vestments, some of which date back to the 15th century, and his work on them. So I have a very clear picture of how these vestments have been restored and repaired and so on. From Hopkins's point of view, I think he would have been drawn to Horton because of Horton's strong Lancashire accent. This is apparent in these 12 notebooks. There is not a single punctuation mark in all 12 volumes. There is not a single capital letter. and they are spelt phonetically. So with somebody who has an ear to language and an eye for beauty, messing around in the sacristy under Brother Horton's stern management would have definitely had an impression on him. So we know, for instance, that Hopkins was there helping to lay out the vestments for the great procession in Corpus Christi. He would have seen particularly this vestment, and I'm sure that it lodged in his mind when he was thinking about that dove. The embroidery that Helena Winter employed on these 17th century creations, she made three-dimensional embroideries. They're almost completely proud of the backing on them, which makes them very awkward to wear. They're made from silver and gold ribbon, from silver and gold wire, coloured silks, precious stones, pearls, opals, rubies, her own earrings from her jewellery box. They're designed to flicker and flash and move. And if you imagine in the 17th century when she was making them, Catholicism was illegal in England. And as you know, her own father and uncles were executed. And many of the other priests that she was working for and working with ended up in prison or executed for their religion. So the chapel would have been a dark, private place, hidden away, because you didn't want anybody to know that Mass was taking place. And it would have been lit by candlelight. And on the back of the priest, moving as he goes through the slow, choreographed liturgy, this three-dimensional dove would catch the light and sparkle and shimmer. And this massive embroidery on the back of the Pentecost chasuble, it's about 18 inches long. The dove's wings are spread out like the sunburst, and from it are coming gold sun rays, and then dripping between the sun rays, pearls and diamonds and little tongues of fire with enameled jewels on them. And these rather odd looking things, which you can imagine are jellyfish until you realize that they're puffs of wind blowing the mighty wind of Pentecost from the wings of the dove down through the vestment. And at the bottom of the vestment is the single letters HW, Helena Winter. So she's there at the bottom receiving the power of this beautiful, the gifts of the Holy Spirit. I just want to leave you with this idea that perhaps it was the image of this ethereal, warm-breasted, silver-winged dove so central to Helena's work, because it appears on many of her vestments, and it would have been familiar to Hopkins. And who knows, but the remembrance of that encounter, rummaging around in the sacristy with those remarkable vestments between 1870 and 73 when he was at Stonyhurst, planted a seed which flowered in the poem God's Grandeur a few years later.
Gosh, that's wonderful, Jan. And just as you're talking, I was thinking about this figure of embroidery and something that you bring out so well. And it occurs to me also in things Rebecca was saying, and also matters that I was edging towards, that embroidery, in a sense, is a perfect invitation to understand Hopkins for that double sense in which to really understand it and appreciate it as you do, Jan, as curator. You presumably need to do two things at once. You need to get up very close to it and admire its warp and weft and think about its intricacies and so on. And Rebecca has helped us do that in thinking about individual word choices and so on. And I've tried to nudge us thinking about certain kinds of sound structures. And at the same time, though, one needs to stand back and to see the whole picture, to see really what it is. One needs to consider it as a whole. Hopkins has a wonderful line in which he says, an effect is nothing but the way in which the mind ties together, not the sequences, but all the condition it sees. So I think that's a kind of wonderful, I suppose, passing party bag metaphor that we can take with us, Jan, the sense of embroidery being this cue for Hopkins, not merely in this astonishing image, which I don't believe has been published anywhere. And I'm hoping to get you to do so, Jan, in the Hopkins Quarterly, which is now partnered with Stonyhurst, the International Journal of Hopkins Studies. But I just think more broadly as a kind of governing metaphor to go away with, that the bright wings can keep us honest with Hopkins, to attend to the minute particulars, as Blake would say, but also to stand back and feel like Ian McKellen said, you know, it's just like a bomb going off, just to see the whole thing.
Before I say a few final things, I just would love to return to what Jan has offered us, which is so rich and carefully considered. And in pairing this careful scientific fascination that Hopkins's capacious, impressionable mind had, impairing his interest in science with also his fascination and deep care for the liturgy, the vestments, the choreography of liturgy itself that you so nicely teased out for us, Jan. We really see this beautiful integration of the scientific, of the rational, the philosophical in Hopkins' mind, with also his deep devotion, his religious convictions, his religious sense, really. And he pairs the two together and integrates them in this beautiful way to show a deep sympathy and actually interdependence between faith and reason, which I think he's always modeling in his scientifically precise method of crafting his poetry that's also deeply imbued with a religious sensibility. And in this way, I actually think that his poetry can pair very beautifully with a recent encyclical that Pope Francis has written called Laudato Si, which is focused on care for our common home and the way in which certain aspects of Christian theology, and especially its rootedness in Trinitarian theology, is, as Pope Francis proposes, a way to help us think about certain relationships between faith and reason, between philosophy, our common values, and how we care for the environment. And you see all of these different threads and themes held together so nicely in Hopkins, and done in a way that's not forced or imposed, but that organically emerges and develops as he grows in his own thinking, in his own religious experience, and in his training as a Jesuit, his ministry from Oxford to Glasgow to Dublin, and so on. And there's something very timely about his work. And I think in what we've been talking about over the last hour or so, really helps to show and reinforce how much value there is to thinking about nature, the environment, the relationship between faith and science with Hopkins. He's a great guide. I'd like to close with a short comment by Hopkins that really ties together so many of the themes that we've been exploring in this podcast. But thank you both for such a rich conversation. And let's close fittingly with Hopkins' own words. All things, therefore, are charged with love, are charged with God. And if we know how to touch them, give off sparks and take fire, yield drops and flow, ring and tell of him.